It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and your head...
America, and good morning, world. Welcome to book, chapter, and verse 130 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively right here on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch. That's crmw.net. Coal River Mountain Watch. Stop by crmw.net and have a look at what mountaintop removal is doing to the state of West Virginia. I'm so glad to be back with you this evening. Apparently, at Easter, I found something more than a basket full of eggs. I found a little case of bronchitis and actually really knocked me for a loop. I've been pretty much sleeping for 2 days straight, and so it's awfully good to be back with you. And if you can put up with my voice that switches between very low bass and some sort of a mid-range, I sound like a teenager going through puberty, but nonetheless, I am glad to be back with you this evening. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Thursday, March the 27th, 2008. So if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time on a Thursday, that is March the 27th, 2008, you are indeed listening to a live show, and I'll be giving you the contact numbers in just a few moments if you'd like to talk with myself and to the guest whom I'll be introducing shortly. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and over at strictlyconfidentialradio.com you'll find links to all of the guests' websites. You'll find links to the audio archives from prior shows, and you'll find links there to the chat room. The chat room is active at this very moment and is a wonderful place to hang out during any of the programming that you hear on the Head On Radio Network. Some of the smartest and most amusing people on the entire planet are located in the Head On Radio Network chat room. You'll also find that the chat room posts useful links related to what I'm talking about, what the guests are talking about, and what the other hosts are talking about. So you'll also find the chat room to be not only entertaining from a chat point of view, you'll find it useful in terms of links. You'll find links at at strictlyconfidentialradio.com, the Head On Radio Network main site, where you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network. There are links there for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. In this show, Strictly Confidential has been blessed. I've used that term several times. We've had such wonderful performers on this show: Cynthia Manley, Susie Brenner, Linda Beckstead, Matt Gold, Ernest Cole, D.C. LaRue, Daryl Russ, Mark Silver, Justin Utley, Jason DeMarco, Scott Free, the list goes on and on. And that list doesn't even include the wonderful producers and DJs that have been on the show. It's about time I gave thanks to Mr. Glenn Rivera. Mr. Glenn Rivera works very hard behind the scenes in supporting this particular show, and it is very much appreciated. It was Glenn who brought us Cynthia Manley, It was Glenn who brought us Ernest Cole. It was Glenn who brought us D.C. LaRue. And in fact, it is Glenn who brings us Mr. Paul Parker, who will be our guest this evening. In fact, it is much credit to Glenn Rivera. He has actually put Strictly Confidential on the map, musically speaking. And that's very kind of you, Glenn. We do appreciate your support. Glenn will be listening to the show via delayed stream. He has a meeting tonight. Also, a thanks goes to both Glenn and Larry Sanders for providing the music tracks that you're going to hear on the show. There's a special place in my heart for Paul Parker. I remember clearly when I DJed in the gay clubs in Portland, Oregon during the early 80s to about 85, 86. I remember very clearly playing Paul Parker's records. There was Desire, Right on Target, Shot in the Dark, Shot in the Night, Love's on the Line, Too Much to Dream. The list goes on and on. I remember it very, very clearly. Paul Parker also did not stop when I stopped DJing and moved back to Florida. Paul Parker kept right on. He has released record after record after record all the way through the early 80s, all the way through the 90s. And in fact, will be bringing us a brand new track this evening called Don't Stop. In addition to Don't Stop that Paul is going to be running for us this evening, we have a huge anthology of his previous work. So that's great news, and we welcome him to the show. I should say to you that one of the interesting things about Paul Parker is so little is known about him. Unless you happen to be a friend of Paul Parker or know him directly, about the only piece of information you can find about Paul Parker on the Internet is that he was born in San Francisco, California. Now, beyond that, of course, you can find lists of his records and when they were introduced, but there is a huge missing gap between being born in San Francisco and bursting onto the club scene in the 1980s. We hope to fill that in this evening. And Paul Parker, welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Peter, thank you.
Thank you for being with us. It's delightful to have you along. I'm so grateful to our friend Glenn Rivera for pushing that through. Glenn's quite an interesting man.
Yeah, Glenn's a great guy.
Yes, he is. Paul, how in the world did you manage to remain under the radar for so many years? As I was saying just before I introduced you, the only thing we know is that you're born in San Francisco. So what's page two? We skip all the way to about page 30, and we don't know what happened after that. Did you come from a musical family in San Francisco?
No. Prior to meeting Patrick Kelly, I was a club and coffee house singer, basically, in San Francisco. And I did the tunes of the day, Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young, Stephen Stills especially, basically anything of the time that we felt like we wanted to sing in a cover band.
And, well, of course,
Patrick Kelly wasn't involved. No, I didn't know him until actually in about 1979 is when I met Patrick. So then I was on Castro Street one day, and a friend of mine introduced me to Patrick, and that basically started everything along the path it went on. That was the first time I met someone that actually wanted to record and show me the different things about recording, because there was quite a bit to learn, it turned out.
Well, of course, Patrick is legend to anyone who comes from the gay community, and even people from the straight community, too. He was, when I use the word legendary, I use it lightly. He was the man who was the music for so long, his own works and albums, and he worked with so many wonderful artists. Of course, have lost Patrick due to AIDS, and it was a terrible loss. But nonetheless, Patrick was the man to meet. How fortunate that you were introduced to him. What were your initial conversations like with Patrick?
Well, it's been so long ago, it's hard to remember, but we immediately realized that we both wanted the same thing. We wanted to sing, we wanted to produce, we wanted to write songs. And basically, after meeting the first day, we decided to work together and became immediate friends, and we're best friends for the rest of the time that Patrick was with us. And he was just an amazing person. He knew exactly what he wanted. We were both just two guys hanging out on Castro Street at first, in the jeans, the boots, the T-shirt, he had been a drummer, and also then he'd been a lighting man at the City Disco, and he knew all about disco, and I didn't know a thing at the time. And he was basically had just gotten off a tour with Sylvester, where he'd done a European tour for Mighty Reel and Dance to the Beat of the Disco Heat. And there he was sitting on Castro Street, and they had let him go off the tour, and they decided synthesizers were out, and there wasn't going to be any anymore. And so fortunately, I was right there, met him, and we were working together from then on.
So then you were with Patrick when he formed the Megatone label, is that right, when that first appeared?
First, he met the singers that were the Patrick Cowley Singers that became the Patrick Cowley Singers, and I was basically part of that. We worked together a little bit. The first album came out, I think, in 1981, and it was the first Patrick Cowley Megatron Man album, and I was on the track Liftoff. In the fall of 1981.
Well, anyone who was around the dance floor in the early 80s immediately is hearing Liftoff in their heads and hearing Megatron Man. Who could forget? They were huge. And these tracks charted, if I'm not mistaken. These charted fairly high and across the board at Billboard, did they not?
Yeah, exactly. And I had a friend that was in Europe. Actually, it was Ken, my lover. That became my lover right at that time. And he was over in Germany and in France, and everywhere he went, every disco he went, he was hearing Liftoff and all the other tracks off the album. And just called over one time and said, "You can't believe what's going on here. These songs are being played everywhere." And basically we just knew them as the songs that Patrick had just finished about 2 months before. And next thing you know, they were all over the States. And literally from that time on, it was like a big whoosh. Everything just kept going for Patrick
wow.
and I at the time.
Well, Paul, you know, I have to ask, you very likely still are, but in the 80s, you were most definitely what you would consider a heartthrob. What was it like performing in the 80s when everybody was after you in every possible way? That had to be one heck of a ride.
Well, it was something I didn't dwell on, basically. It was just part of the genre that we were in or something. It was just the glitz kind of went along with the music. So whatever they said, that just was what they said. And I just posed for the pictures and went along with it and just kept singing. That was my thing, was to become a singer, songwriter, and that I just kept that focus in mind. And with Patrick, he had his definite forces that he loved. He was into Tamita. He was into, at the time, Walter Carlos, who then became Wendy Carlos, and Vangelis, and he was developing his studio all along. And basically through everything that we did together, he developed, and I fortunately was able to develop as a singer, and we just kept going as far as we could.
Well, Paul, I neglected to put out our telephone numbers at the beginning of the show. I skipped over that. If you'd like to talk with myself and Paul, the toll-free line is 877, the number 4, head-on. That translates into 877-443-2366. If you have unlimited long distance, you can use that and save the studio a nickel or a buck. That's area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia. And I normally do try to check the email during the breaks, too. That's Peter at headonradionetwork.com. And by the way, Paul, we are posting a link to your site in the chat room, but for those of you who are not in chat, you can find out about Paul at paulparkermusic.com. That's paulparkermusic.com. Paul, there were precious few men who made it in the way that you made it back in the day with the huge mega hits on the dance floor. And, you know, Lord knows the DJs, myself included, love to play your music. But besides you and of course, Sylvester, I can't think of any. Were there others that I just missed during the 80s?
Well, it's funny. There were quite a few more, but it's funny you say that because when I first got with Patrick, the first thing we did was produce about three or four songs, and we had demo tapes, and we went all around to the as many record companies as we could hit on, and they said, well, yeah, the music's good, but, you know, you can't use a man for that kind of music. So we had a song called Love Me Hot. We had Peter Brown was one of the guys in the early times there. He had done a song called Crank It Up, and Patrick took Crank It Up, and he edited out all the vocals so that I could have a version to sing if I sang live. And so I was at the time I was singing Love Me Hot, that was written by Patrick, and Crank It Up, and he had a few other songs that he put together so I could have a four-song show tape. So very few people at that time had a friend like Patrick that could actually make something that for them, make something like that for them that they could then take to a club, put into the sound system, and then sing live. So that was I think, one of the determining reasons why I even was able to get going, was because I had that guy to do that for me, and he was such a great guy, and he knew exactly what to do. And he was kind of like a crash course in recording and synths, and for me, rhythm, because I'd been singing more just songs that just, you know, were nice to sing, but they didn't have a lot of Latin rhythm, they didn't have a lot of punchy rhythm, and so with him, it was always like, no, it goes da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and he would push that, and basically I learned how to do that when I worked with him. So he also worked with, at the time, at that particular time, I learned about drum loops, which is what he started with. He took a drum loop off of a song, recorded it onto this little 12-inch piece of tape, put it on a reel-to-reel tape recorder, and then play it around and around and around after we edited it together. So it was just one little continuous piece of tape. Then he would put that down on the 8-track studio machine, and that would be our basis for the song that then he basically recorded. So he started in a simple way because we couldn't have a drummer. It was too hard to get the perfect rhythm, but with this little piece of tape, you could get a great 130 BPM rhythm or 124, whatever you're starting with. So he had these little tricks that a lot of people didn't know about to start with, and then he'd build the song on top of that.
Well, Patrick was certainly one of the main influences for the high-energy sound as it began to... And by and large, your tracks, too, were very high-energy.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm wondering if later on there you reduced that pace some. In the ones that I DJed during the early 80s and up to about 86. Are there other tracks, for instance, even the cover tracks that you've done that I'm aware of, for instance, Time After Time, is a very high-energy version. And, of course, I've always been partial to high-energy music, but I have to ask you if you've gone into lower ranges or what we would call morning music.
Well, we did a few things. Actually, Patrick and I basically stayed with the 124 to 130 BPM, which is the faster things. But as I worked with a few of the other producers, we did a few slower things. Like with Man Parrish, I did a couple of songs that one was called No Mercy. One Look Was Enough was actually the slowest one I did, and that was my 1987 Billboard song. That was number one Billboard dance song. So basically it was from 1982 to 1987 that I really did the most work, and that one was 118 beats per minute, so that's a little bit slower. But I never really went to the morning music. I just never got down any farther than that.
Well, that was the range that I was always partial to. Paul, I'm wondering too.
I don't know. None of the producers ever brought it up. I just never really discussed it. So we just kept at that. We just kept at a faster pace.
Well, Paul, was there camaraderie or was there a lot of competition between you and the other male artists? Well, throughout your career, but particularly back in the 80s, how was that? Was it cutthroat? How was that?
Basically, if we were on the club circuit and we were. You would go and you would do your Friday night or your Saturday night. You wouldn't really meet the other artists. They would be on the Friday, Saturday before you or whatever. And so I think sometimes when we had a group show where there'd be three or four artists, I would meet people. But basically, I never really got to know any of the other male artists. I did meet Sharon Redd, got to know Sharon Redd. Pamela Stanley, of course, is still one of my best friends. Let's see, Debbie Jacobs was just fantastic and is still an amazing person. The sweetest thing on wheels, that girl. And I can remember one time walking through Grand Central Station in New York, and everyone came to her. It was like some kind of magnet, and including the people that were down and out, and they would just come right at her, and I'd say to her, Debbie, are you looking at those people? Stop it. You can't be looking at those people, because they were coming over and panhandling then. She says, I don't do that. It just, this is the way it is whenever I walk through a place like this. So she was an amazing person.
I'll be darned. Well, as you listed those people, in each case, my heart immediately remembered playing the music, the wonderful music.
One of my favorite songs still.
Yeah. Well, Paul, I need to introduce you to Hank Steinhauer. Now, Hank is one of the DJs that has appeared on this show before. He's been a guest, and he's calling in and would like to talk with us. So, Hank Steinhauer, welcome back to Strictly Confidential, sir. Are you with us, Hank?
Yes.
Ah, oh, wonderful. Well, can you hear me okay, Hank?
Yeah, great. Let me turn down my computer here. Okay.
Okie doke. Okay. Yeah, it's kind of...
Down,
gets
down
a little
front
bit
of... about 15 seconds apart.
Yeah, it takes a while for the audio to get down the internet, so there's a very odd delay. Well, Paul Parker, meet Hank Steinhauer. Now, Hank is in Miami. Welcome.
Hello.
Go ahead, Hank.
Welcome, Paul. Thank you. I want to ask you, as Peter, I'm a high energy playing fella here, and I admired your thing and Anthony Stevens. You did the work with Lisa on Doing It, and Thing Called Love, and Pamela Stanley did the Running Around in Circles and Stranger in a Strange Land. Can you talk a bit about your experiences working with Ian Anthony?
Yes, Ian came along in 1983. I went to England for the first time, and this guy walked into my show that I was doing in London and said I had a song with Hazel Dean called Searching, and I don't even believe I'd heard it at the time. This was kind of early on, and it was before it was really as big as it got. And he said, and I know your stuff, I know Patrick Kelly's stuff, and I'd love to work with you. So I think it was, I came home, and about 3 weeks later, he was at my house for about 3 weeks, and we did Desire and the first things that we did. And he's a terrific producer. I learned a lot of things from him also.
Well, I have to say, in looking through some of Ian's work earlier this afternoon, of course, his name comes up when looking for information on you, Paul, and I finally turned the printer off after it kicked out 13 pages of his music. The man was really amazing.
Mm-hmm. Did the Cut Glasses Without Your Love, which I thought was a big improvement, by the way, you know.
That was a lot of fun to do because I had remembered that from the earlier, the Cut Glass version, dancing to it in the clubs, and then when he said, "Oh, let's do that," and I thought, "Oh, okay," because it's not easy to do some of those, you know, bluesier licks like that, and be heartfelt at the same time, because that was the whole idea, is to be, you know, to make a connection with the people that we were singing to, because here I was, a gay man in a gay club, and one of the only ones, and I'm singing, every minute that I have you here beside me, I hope to God that your love won't be denied me. It's just, you know, it's just incredible. So the lyrics were just amazing. Some of those songs, if you think of yourself singing to a gay audience.
What got you to do this guy Saxon?
Pardon?
What got you to redo when you did Sky Saxon's? Pushing Too Hard?
Oh, Pushing Too Hard, yeah. Well, Patrick loved the 60s stuff. And, of course, we'd both been listening to radio during that time. as teenagers, and we decided to do Pushing Too Hard to have a big kind of a pounding thing. The funny thing about that one was they actually speeded it up from 136 or 134 beats to 140 to make it a little bit more driving, more of a rock driving track. And then when I went to sing it live, I didn't know they'd done that. It was too high, because when you speed something up, your voice goes higher. So every time I'd sing it, I'd wear my voice out, and I thought, well, what's wrong with me? I can't hit the high notes, and I had no clue that they had even done it. Because in the early days, I didn't know what a BPM was. I didn't know, you know, I didn't even know when you went to a disco that people were mixing records together like that, from, you know, and speeding one up and slowing the other down so that they'll mesh perfectly. And, you know, I had no clue. I'd go to a dance party and just listen to what the DJ did and not even think about it. And then only later, when I started recording these things, and they said, oh, well, you're going to do a, you know, 130 BPM this time, and I'd say okay, what's that? So, you know, it was a big learning curve for me, because, like I said, until I met Patrick, I had never really gone to a dance disco evening anywhere. So, and after that, I hardly ever was without it, basically every weekend, and all over the world. I ended up going in almost every disco we could get into.
How is it singing with Pamela Stanley?
Pamela Stanley is, the funny thing is, we're born on the same day, we're the same age. It's like, I don't know, we're like doppelganger or something, I'm not sure what it is, but she's a really wonderful person, and when we sang the two songs that we did, Running Running Circles and Stranger in a Strange Land, that was really a fun time. And also, we did a song for Debbie Jacob called I Will Fear No Evil that came out on Disco Net, I think. And Pamela was in the background on that, along with Betty Wright and Jessica Williams. And that was one of the most incredibly fun recording times that I ever can remember. And we spent about 3 or 4 hours in the studio together. We just had a party. It was just a lot of fun. So those people are fantastic people, every single one of those women. Betty Wright just was like, here, try this, do this. You know, she gave real artistic thought to what
she's a Miami person, you know. She got her thing here. She's one of the first ones we played here.
Yeah, I feel so lucky to have met people like that. You know, those kind of people are, and the artists are just fantastic. And to have actually worked with them like that, that's really one of the highlights. And that song didn't do much. It, you know, it was just on DiscoNet, I think, maybe a couple other remix services.
Great. Thank you. Well, appreciate you taking the time. And Peter,
thank
you.
Great talking to you.
Okay.
You take
care.
Thank
you, Hank. We appreciate the call. Good evening. Hank is... one of our dear friends here, Paul. He's a very high energy DJ, and he plays in Miami, but he goes back to the early days in New York, and he certainly knows his stuff. Paul, I have to ask
you. He got me excited there. He got me excited about that stuff.
he's a great guy. He really knows his stuff. I have to ask you talk about the camaraderie and for instance, Betty Wright saying, try this, try that, and all the water. Has the music business changed a lot since then? Because I sometimes wonder if it hasn't gotten pretty ugly these days, or do you still feel any sense of camaraderie?
Well, I'm not really sure. I'm doing what I've done with the paulparkermusic.com, Don't Stop What You're Doing to Me, and Just Hold On to Love. Those are the first two songs that I've done in a while, and Jeff Creary is my Utmosis is his label. He's a fantastic new producer that I'm working with, but we work together, he and I, and we do everything on computer. So I'm not sure if that's what it kind of makes you. If you and the computer and it's your studio, you don't necessarily work with other people as much as we used to, I guess.
I see.
Maybe we need to think about trying that, I guess.
Well, yeah, there is something lost when you don't see the people. But what a wonderful story to bring that alive. You know, Paul, I have to tell you, we have a number of straight listeners. They're LGBT friendly, progressive folks. and of course an LGBT audience also. But I would imagine that a lot of our listeners have not heard some, or at least in their minds can't place it. All the DJs can, and the people back at the floors can. But some of these, so I'm looking forward to running some of your music. We have assembled a list here, thanks to Glenn Rivera and also Larry Sanders. In addition to your new track, Don't Stop. But before we do, we run Don't Stop, which I want you to tell us all about how the inspiration behind that. I'd love to run one of your older tracks, if that's okay, just to give the audience an idea.
Sure.
Well, would you do us the honor of picking it out? Do you have our track list handy? Is that a possibility?
Yeah, let's play Right on Target. That was my first song with Patrick Cowley. That was featuring me.
Yes, great track. I'm so glad you chose that one. Bob, if you would roll the Right on Target track, please. Okay, Bob is locating the track for us now. He'll have it in just a second here. And be rolling. This is an interesting remix, by the way. It's one that I had not heard before this evening, or actually earlier today. I played it. It's an interesting remix and a great track. It certainly goes back to the day. Bob, do we have it ready?
This is the Marty Blackman remix.
Yes. Wonderful track. Okay, I'm not sure exactly what's wrong at the studio, but they will let me. Thank you. Wonderful stuff, Paul. And by the way, you've acquired some new fans in the chat room who are not familiar with some of your earlier songs, and I certainly recall playing that back in the day. Paul, is this one of the tracks that you sang live to a gay audience?
Oh, yeah. That was, well, I always sing live, and sometimes I would actually come into a disco, and they would say, okay, you're going to sing here, and they would clear the dance floor where all the sound was, because that's where people danced, and they'd put you in the middle and say, that's where you're going to sing. And I was one of the first wow. people to say, well, no, I'm not, because if you hand me the microphone here, I get feedback. I'm going to sing over yeah. there, and I'd move the whole show over to the side of the room so that I just used the edge of the speakers as my sound, and then everybody would get in the dance floor again, and it was more of a party because they were where they were supposed to be, and I was off mm-hmm. to the side. And it worked so much better in most clubs that it became wherever we worked it out to where it would sound best, that's where they'd do the shows from then on. Because they were used to having tremendous feedback during all of their shows. But
yeah.
everybody just lived with it because that was just the way it was in a small disco in, you know, wherever it was. And so it was kind of interesting how it sort of developed into the shows got better and better as time went on because everybody had better setups for the singers.
Well, it is funny how a lot of the people just don't get it. Let's point all the speakers directly at the mic, and one has to laugh at that. You know,
you never knew whether the show was going to be what it was going to be because you would come and you'd get picked up at the airport, and then they'd take you to the sound check, then they'd drop you off at the hotel. And then you'd have dinner, and then you'd wait a few hours, and then depending when the party was, it was either at 2 a.m. or 6 a.m., they'd come get you, and they'd take you to the party, and then you would sing, and you never knew whether there was going to be a crowd, whether what it was going to be, whether the music was going to be any good or the sound was any good, because no matter what the sound check, the show was a whole other thing. But usually, it really came together somehow, and the show was almost always good. And then if it was good, then they'd have you back the next few months later or maybe the next year, depending on how many artists they brought in. And some of the shows were just incredible. Like one of my favorite shows of all time was I did Saint on Halloween in 1982, and it was Road Warrior time. The movie had been out that summer, and everybody, the whole place was Road Warrior. And they had shaved their heads, and they had the feathers, and they had, you know, it was naked, whatever they could get away with, and the whole place, over 5,000 people packed in there, and I got to sing right on target and pushing too hard, and it was just amazing. And in the Saint, they had a giant dome that was a planetarium, and they in the center, the planetarium device would come up through the floor, and it'd shoot the stars onto the ceiling. And then in the side where you would come out to sing, this huge garage door would open up in the dome, and there you'd be standing, and your music would start. And they would mix you in from the record into your songs, and no one really knew what was going on until that thing started to rise. And then when I was there, the cheering started, and I couldn't hear my song, so I didn't know where to start sing.
Oh, no.
And it was just, it was amazing. And to see, you know, 5,000 people staring at you in that kind of situation was quite incredible, and that was really one of the most exciting shows I did, I think, in the 1982 time.
Yeah, well, of course, the Saint is legendary, and what an evening that had to have been. Were you singing in the style of some of the? I've seen some of your the videos on YouTube that come from back in the day. Was that the general style that you did that evening at the Saint?
Well, what they'd originally tried to do with me, because Laverty had been one of Patrick's groups, and Laverty was Frank Laverty and two women, and they had like a group choreography that they did, and they sang Die Hard Lover. Patrick had written Die Hard Lover with them, and that was a great song. But they would do this cute little choreography during the chorus part, and just kind of Frank would sort of wiggle his knees, and the girls would sort of go along with it. So they were choreographed perfectly through the whole thing. So with me, when I came along with Right on Target at about the same time, they said, oh, what are we going to make him do? So they sent me to a choreographer, and I said, well, there's three people there with Laverty, and they can do choreography, but what does one person do? And so what I realized early on with Right on Target was the one person tells the story. You tell the story and you connect with the crowd directly. You don't have to be a glitzy choreographed piece of work there. You just have to connect with the crowd, which is what I worked on doing, and I think I got pretty good at it. Those YouTube videos, most of them are not really the song that I'm actually singing. The thing filmed is another song, and so there's no lip syncing to it. Usually I'm singing Shot in the Night, but they're playing Right on Target.
I see. So, yes, I think maybe that might have been what I came across today. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're a little awkward, but we didn't really do videos back in 1982, 83, 84. There was very few cameras at any show that would have footage right now. So it meant some of the only stuff that was ever done was in Mexico.
Yeah. Well, our friend Glenn Rivera is big into doing the videos. He's has done a series for Cynthia Manley and some of the others. I feel quite sure he would jump at the chance to hook you up with video.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm actually going to be meeting Glenn next month. We've only talked by telephone for the last 5 or 6 months, and we'll be meeting finally next month. Yeah, I'm going to be taking a trip down south, and I'll be able to get together with him.
I see.
My friend Carrie. My friend Carrie's listening. My friend Maya's listening. And Jeff, I'm sure Jeff's on the line here.
Yes. Well, we welcome them aboard. And if you'd like to call in, I again point out I don't give the numbers out often enough, to tell you the truth. The toll free line is 877. The number 4 head on, that's 877-4 head on. Or if you have unlimited long distance, you can use that. It's area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. And that rings in West Virginia. Paul, that's the story that you just told about Die Hard Lover and the choreography that brought a huge smile to my face. We've all of us have played the music and listened to it, but so many of us never saw you in live, and it's just what an amazing change that had to be for you too. What was the other track you mentioned, Pushing Too Hard? Now, those were released about the same time, were they not?
We did a double release on the single. Right on Target was the A side, and Pushing Too Hard was the B side. And Right on Target was more of a disco club, and Pushing Too Hard ended up being more of a rock club, Latin club. So we covered, that was partly why we did so well with it, because we covered three club styles at the time. And because
Very
a lot of clubs wouldn't play Right on Target, they would play Pushing Too Hard only. And some would play both. But you could get more reporters reporting your song. And Right on Target was the first number one Billboard dance song that Patrick Kelly and I had, because of that partly.
Well, was it Patrick's idea to use Pushing Too Hard on the other side because of the difference in style? Was that Patrick that thought of that?
It was Patrick, also Marty Bleckman, who was the record company and our DJ. He had worked at Alfie's for a long time in San Francisco. That was where I first met him. And then when I sang Right on Target, and Patrick and he got together to form the record company, that was just where the DJ part of it came from, was from Marty. And also, he was the one that really wanted to do the record company. Patrick just said, well, okay, if that's what we should do, we'll do it. And next thing you know, there was Megatone Records. So.
Yes, I clearly remember seeing that label in my eye vividly, spinning round and round on the turntable.
Megatron Man idea, which was a Japanese toy at the time, and Patrick thought that would be a great record label idea, and and Megatron Man then was one of his songs that is a legendary song still.
Yes. Well, Paul, we have a caller. We have Jeff. We actually have your producer on the line. Jeff, welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Hello, and hello, Peter, and hello, Paul.
Hello, Jeff.
Well, welcome. Welcome. If you can hear us okay, Jeff. If you can't hear us okay, just let us know in the studio. We can make some adjustments. Go right ahead.
You can turn yourselves up a little bit if possible, but I can hear you. So, Paul, okay. I heard you talking a little earlier about camaraderie, and I hope they got the idea that you and I have a camaraderie, but kind of like us two guys against the world or against the monolithic record industry. You know, I'll make Paul a breakfast bagel and coffee when he comes in, and we'll get to work. But I do have to say that his voice, and he's in great shape vocally and in every other way, and it's been a real pleasure to work with him because he's always ready to sing. He's not one of these singers who comes in and says, you know, oh, I won't be singing today, or he's just, his voice is always ready to go. And you might even be able to tell from his speaking voice that he's just got a naturally velvety quality to him.
Oh,
well,
thanks,
yes, I do hear that.
Yeah, Jeff,
I do hear it. In fact,
Jeff is a great guy to work with. I've only worked with interesting, great people so far. I mean, it's kind of amazing how it's just sort of happened. Jeff and I met at a Remember the Party, which is a Trocadero, Remember Trocadero party that happens in San Francisco two or three times a year, every year for the last 5 years, I think, now. And we just were there one night, met, could barely talk because the sound was so loud, and next thing you know, we've completed two songs that we've got on iTunes and Amazon.com, and then we're still working on the album to follow with that. So Jeff is a wonderful guy to work with.
Well, I'm looking at the titles now, that Don't Stop What You're Doing to Me, and what is the story behind this? Because it's wonderful that you're releasing music again, Paul, because really you are phenomenal. So, Jeff, were you the person that pushed or prompted Paul to do this?
Well, I'd say he was always ready to go. I was probably just lucky to have met him, and I had been working with a few singers here in San Francisco. My label is highly LGBT-focused. I worked with a guy named Matt Alber, who broke out of San Francisco and is now down in L.A. His album's coming out in a few weeks. And kind of like I love working with vocalists. I love vocal music, and I just wanted to see. I knew of Paul's material, and I just wanted to see what we could do, you know, in 2007, 2008 to excite his fans again. And I'm a big music fan, and I get swept up when, you know, the greats from the 80s return, you know, with a vengeance, and you get excited to know that, you know, they're still there and making great music. So I wanted to help Paul do that. He was certainly
Jeff,
ready to
what
make
is,
the music.
I should say so. Jeff, what is your label? What is the label called?
My label is called Utmosis. That's Utmosis. Another strange name for a label, but for me it was about I named it because everyone I work with I like to share knowledge and passion with, you know, so it's kind of like taking the word osmosis and taking it to the utmost, you know.
Working with Jeff is like having a conversation. When you work with Jeff, we talk about everything that we're doing. We talk about the music, we talk about the sound, we talk about the speed of the song and the lyrics, and basically when we work together, we both do everything. We don't just he doesn't do one thing and then I come in and do another. It's just like a conversation.
Paul is, I'm not one of these producers who makes up tracks in advance. Everything Paul and I have done, we've done from scratch, sitting in the room together. And so it's
sometimes
we're both
just
the songwriters
making
on the tracks, and it's very, very collaborative.
Yeah, sometimes we're just going, making fun.
Huh.
And then that ends up being on the record, so.
Now, sometimes Paul will come in after a long drive to get to my studio, which is in San Francisco, and he'll have an idea that he's been developing along the drive, and he'll run right in, and I'll turn on the mic, and he'll usually he sings it out. He'll start with a little beatbox that he sings, and then he'll start doing the words, and I'll be like, that's it. Another song is born.
Well, they're all remarkable. In fact, I'd like for us to run one of the Don't Stops. We have three versions. We have a radio edit, the original mix, and the extended mix. And are you're involved in all three of these then, Jeff?
Yeah, these mixes are kind of like musically similar, but different edits. So the extended mix has the most variations and...
Yeah,
the original mix was truly the first one we did.
Yeah, we can go with the radio edit. Let's go with the radio edit.
Okay, we could certainly do that. And when was this released? This was just within the last, month or so?
March 4th, 2008 was the release date.
Yes,
so it's
March
still,
4th.
It's about 3 weeks ago.
Brand new music then. Well, Bob has that queued up then, and it's the Don't Stop What You're Doing to Me radio edit, and Bob, that's your track 01. Thanks. That has got all the magic of Paul Parker with today's intensity and beat and impact. That was well done. And Paul, are you still with us, Paul?
Yes, I am.
Oh, I'm wondering who did the arrangement for this? It's ingenious because it fits all of the club sound today without being overly mechanical, if I dare risk saying that.
Yeah, it harkens back to what we did, Patrick and I, in the 80s, and it has that break in the center, and then it lifts a little bit into the third verse. So that was Jeff and I. We, you know, in our conversation, we decided we'd do that, so there it is.
Well, Paul, I neglected to ask you at the beginning of the show if I asked if you came from a musical family, but I didn't ask you if you play musical instruments or write music. Did you have a hand in the instrumentation of that too?
I can play a computer keyboard onto a recording device, which means I can play real time. So I can't sit in a room and play you a nice song, but I could work on it for about 3 days. And then turn it over to you and say, here, this is what I did. So I can play by ear, basically, and I can play as long as I could, you know, as long as I can play a computer, I can do it. But Jeff is the engineer player, and Jeff's a really nice player. He plays wonderfully. And
so Paul definitely shares the role as producer in the room because he knows, he has so much knowledge of what has gone on in music, especially in the dance genre, and he'll make sure that I'm dotting my I's and crossing my T's. And
well, and
definitely
we have
the
other friends.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we have other friends like Paul Goodyear. He's a DJ that is a really good friend that gives us suggestions about things. And who else, Jeff?
But I do have to say that Paul, when he's in the studio, he can tell you, I mean, he can make sure you get the sound. He knows what sound he's looking for, and he'll also bring, you know, the authenticity of, you know, what happened with, you know, various, you know, how the bass line sounded in the 80s. And certainly with Don't Stop, we were trying to mix, you know, to give a nod to the legendary work of Patrick Cowley, but also, of course, give people here in 2008 that contemporary
edge.
Well, I haven't asked you, Paul, who actually wrote these new songs. Now, of course, we all know Patrick Cowley had a lot to do with the original work, but are you a songwriter too? Did you write the lyrics?
I wrote both. Jeff and I wrote both the songs that we've done, that we've released so far. Don't Stop What You're Doing to Me and Just Hold On to Love are the two that we've finished. We have several others that we haven't quite released yet, and so we write the lyrics together and we write the music together.
Wonderful. We have a copy of just
in the coming. Oh, Peter, I'm hoping that in the coming weeks or months we can share a few other tracks with you, because there's stuff going on that Paul hasn't let me share publicly yet, but I'm really anxious to. One of them is an Italian song that's almost like an Italian opera set to a syncopated beat, and it's incredible, but Paul wants to perfect his Italian first. And I think you're going to be really surprised at the range of what we're doing with his album.
Well, actually, that's a wonderful idea. We've had Cynthia Manley on, and we're going to be having her back as soon as she finishes her tour down in Brazil. And we've had Ernest Cole on two or three times, and absolutely, yes, we want to stay in touch and have you back. It's every reason to do that. Paul, what is it like to hear your music again, blasting through the speakers and perhaps being played at the club down the street? Now, when did you leave off? It was in the mid-90s, and you're picking it up now. Is that about the mid-90s?
Yeah, in the 90s I had Wicked Game. It was in 1992. And then I did an album out of England with Wicked Game on it in 1995. And that was pretty much the last thing I did that was a complete album. I did a few other singles in the later 90s through my English label, which I just just haven't worked with for that time. For the late 90s is when we stopped that, and that was all with Ian Anthony Stevens.
Yes, and that was the clone label, if I'm not mistaken. I think One More Hurt and Wicked Game and Can You Feel Love Coming were all on the clone label, is that right?
Exactly, and actually One More Hurt is kind of an interesting song to play. I was wondering if we could play that.
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely, we can run
Peter,
one more
song.
Yes.
I have
yes,
to check
yes.
out because I have another artist who's come into the studio.
Yeah, thanks,
this
Jeff.
Evening. But I did want to tell your listeners, anyone who's a fan of Paul's, whether they became a fan tonight or have been one for many years, if they go to paulparkermusic.com, there's a link to send us an email, and we'll keep you informed of all the events, updates, and releases that are going on. And so don't be shy. Send an email to paul@paulparkermusic.com.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.
Take
Thank
care,
you for
everyone.
Joining us. Have a great evening. We hope to have you back. And, Paul, we're about to run One More Hurt. Now, when was this recorded? We know it's on the English label, the clone label. And this is one of the tracks Larry Sanders found for us and sent in. What's the story behind One More Hurt, and when was that done?
This was done in 95, and actually it turned out I had recorded it in 84 and never released it. And then we needed some more tracks for the album in 95, and Ian went back into the vault and found this song that I had sung. And it was we never had done anything other than do the vocal, and I just sort of was in the studio in England, and I threw it down like in about an hour, and we thought, oh, that's nice, but we didn't really finish it. And instead we did Time After Time and a few of the other things that we did back then. So that's sort of where this one came from. It just ended up being something that he popped out and said, oh, why didn't we finish this?
Wonderful. Well, we're going to run that now. And by the way, I should tell you, Paul, that we're getting requests to hear Time After Time and Wicked Game. Both those are actually wonderful job on both. But for now, let's run from the clone label in England, One More Hurt.
outside looking in. Mm-hmm. So why does it seem I'm losing when I win? Oh. I've tried everything, now I know I can't.
You caught me laughing as we come back from the song, because it really brought back a lot from the energy that you do is unmistakable. And I have to ask, who is the female vocalist that you're doing that with?
Well, then I just remembered what happened with this one is Angie Gold is the singer with me there.
Ah.
And we actually, it didn't go on the album. It ended up being on its own single because we did a version of I Finally Found Someone. It was the Barbra Streisand duet. And this was the flip side to that then, and we released that as a single on Clone. And,
I see.
Yeah, so Angie Gold, I never did meet her. She ended up in the studio over there after I sang it. So.
Ah, so she was doing that by listening to the track you laid down. Interesting.
Exactly, and then working directly with Ian, because Ian produced I Finally Found Someone, and then he wrote One More Hurt himself.
Well, speaking of Ian, you were involved with Ian also with Madeleine Kane for her music, her album called Cover Girl.
That was the first album that I got to be part of songwriting with, other than the Patrick Cowley stuff that we did together. That was really a whole album that Ian and I developed for Madeleine Kane. And she had been a cover girl. A Maybelline eye model, and then
I didn't know that.
A few disco songs earlier, in the late 70s, early 80s, and then they wanted to do an album for her in about 82, 83, I think, and that's when we did the Cover Girl material.
Yes. Well, I'm looking down the track listings for that particular album. Fire is one of them. Such wonderful memories of running those. Did you sing on all or some of these tracks?
I don't think I sang on any of those. We used English backup singers, and they were very funny, and had a great time doing that. They would tear each other up because it turned out they were all friends, and they'd all been on different disco records. And some of them,
yes,
at the time, in the high energy time, sometimes it would be one person singing this record, but another one fronting the record as her. So you go to the club to expect to see Marsha Raven, and instead it was,
yeah,
Norma Lewis singing as Marsha Raven. You go to see Norma Lewis, and it would be Sherade, but instead of Sherade,
I'll be darned.
They ended up being the backup singers. So here they were all switching around for each other because when they had contracts, they couldn't sing sometimes their own hit songs. So they'd have a hit as another artist and then ended up singing each other's songs at different times. It was just really crazy.
Well, you know, that the more I hear about what it was like back in the day from the various their various guests, the crazier it sounds. That's not the first story I've heard similar to that. Who was the group, our friend Alex Ntikin, who's the Italo disco guy, Fun Fun. Apparently Fun Fun was a label, they sang Color My Love. Fun Fun was the label, but it could have been any number of different singers who worked as Fun Fun back in the day.
And I love that song, Color My Love. That was a great one.
Yeah, it's a delightful song. We've run it on the show as a go-to break track. And in fact, so many of the songs that you mentioned this evening, Catch Me and all of those. I mean, who could live without those? And so you helped write then the album for Madeline Kane. Did you help write Fire, or which one of these are all of them?
Cover Girl, I wrote. I tried to write things for her that she could, you know, because she sort of had an image of as this beautiful cover girl. And I wrote Ecstasy, and I can't remember the others right now. I don't have that in front of me.
Yeah, printed this out earlier today. And, you know, her list of album credits goes back a long way, too. And Ian Anthony.
Oh, I ever met. I met her at a club in East L.A. one time, and it was her party. She was having a Madeline Kane party at this East L.A. club, and I went there. And I guest spotted right on target to the audience, and that was one of the first times I saw people explode to that song. And I had never really known what I was doing. I was working with Mr. Kelly, I was singing, and I went to this club and they played it and I sang it live, and the place, it was just like a big huge party, and I was like, I could not believe it. Because I didn't really think, you know, I hadn't really connected what I was doing. I was doing dance music now instead of the previous kind of music. And that was a really exciting club. I'll never forget that one. And Madeline had a huge poster up. She was doing all the, only something about diamonds is one of her songs. Only Rough Diamond, I think it was called. And she did her whole 20 minutes, and then I got to just spot right on target and pushing too hard. So it was really a fun night.
Well, back in the day, did you, you know, we've had some DJs in the show who, you know, who played some of the very large clubs, you know, the Studio 54 and Fire Island, and, you know, the list goes on and on. Did you work closely with some of the DJs back in the day, helping to promote your music, or what was your interface with the DJs back then?
I would call them occasionally and say hello, and because I'd met a lot of them as I was touring, and then when I had another record, I could call them up and say hello and say, by the way, I have another one, and if they weren't playing it, they would then know about it. Bob Miro is one of my best friends. Still, I don't know how many years later, I don't even want to say, and he's in Florida, and he was one of the DJs at Backstreet, a club in Florida, and Fort Lauderdale, and let's see, there's several other people. Oh, Howard Merritt was one of my best friends years ago from New York, and then he ended up down in Florida eventually. Those were two of my long-time most close relationships with DJs, and of course Marty Blechman, the original label executive of Megatone Records, and actually John Hedges has been a nice influence over the years, and someone that I can call even now and just say hello to and visit with. So,
well, Paul, I'm wondering about some of the we all know the remix services, like DiscoNet is one, and Hot Tracks. Was your music remixed by DJs from time to time on either one of those labels or others, and or Razormaid, any number of?
What did you
think of it?
They would call us and request if they could, and we'd give them permission. Yeah.
And what did you think of the results?
They were all good. They were similar to that Right on Target. That was not the original Right on Target. That was the Marty Blechman re-edit remix.
Yeah.
They took parts of it and underlaid it while they were... So they re-recorded two versions to make that happen. And some of it was done in editing then, too. But a lot of times they'd play two records to get a mix like that. And because people were doing that in the club, if you go to a club, you hear you're right on target, right on target, right on target, right on target.
Yes.
And it was interesting because they started doing that about, I think in about 84 or 85, they started doing things like that.
Yeah. Well, I've often run DiscoNet and the hot tracks here, you know, from time to time, between breaks we've come to know and love those here on the show. We've always considered it one of the holy grails. You know, they go back to the very beginning of time, so you have to give them respect for having done so much music. Paul, we'll run some more of your music. Now, you mentioned Just Hold On to Love. Now, that was a song that you've done just a few months prior to Don't Stop. Is Just Hold On to Love within the last?
The other recent one that I've done with Jeff Creary.
And when was it released? Was it released in 07?
Yes, I think in December, 07.
And I'm wondering, what is the response to? Are you getting good response from the DJs in the clubs? Do you have a handle on what's going on in the clubs with the music?
I'm not really sure if it's being played in clubs. I've given it to a few people directly, and I know they're playing it, but I don't really know exactly what the response is. Don't Stop is really the one that people started playing right off. Just Hold On to Love is a little bit more laid back, and so that's why we sort of beefed up Don't Stop a little bit to see if that would work. Yeah, so we still have to wait to see on both of those.
I see. Well, would it be okay if we ran Just Hold On to Love, or do you have another favorite?
I'd like to hear the other two that you mentioned.
Wicked Game and Can You... Yes, Wicked Game, and there were the other one that was... there was a request for Wicked Game and... Yes, and time after time. Thank you. I sometimes lose my train of thought.
Let's do those.
Okay, that sounds like a great idea.
Go to the website and listen to Just Hold On to Love.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Thank you. I listened to Wicked Game earlier today, and I was very impressed. And it's a great song, to say the least. Bob, if you would run the Wicked Game track, and then when we come back, we have a caller for you. Paul will come back with the caller.
Okay, great.
people do.
About holding a note, my man, you just you have certainly made some new fans in the chat room. I wish you could see the praise they're throwing out about it. They just love that track, and I think in many ways, you know, it was kind of a crossover. I'm sure it was played in the straight clubs. I'm hearing that from the folks in chat, and also in the gay clubs too. That both remarkable energy. And you know, you've already had a DJ caller from Miami, and now we're going diagonally to the opposite end of the country. You have caller DJ RXMX, who is also Rick Ashbaum, calling from Seattle, Washington. Welcome to the show.
Hi, everybody.
Hello. Hi there. Welcome. You're on with Paul.
Yeah, boy, what a surprise, Peter. I can't believe that I'm in the same virtual room with not just you, Peter, but with the Paul Parker.
Thanks, Rick.
This is a real blessing to hear you on the show, Paul.
Oh, thank you.
The first thing that I wanted to say, that kind of one of the things that inspired me to call was, for one, the 2-side 12-inch that you came out with in 1982, right on target, and then on the flip side was Pushing Too Hard. Great title, by the way, Pushing Too Hard. But anyway, that was a great, great record. And I first just wanted to mention that to you, how great that record was. Right on Target was played a lot at Seattle's Monastery Dance Club. And Pushing Too Hard was played quite a bit too. That was just a great, great 12-inch. So I wanted to comment on that. The second thing that I wanted to comment on was about the album that you came out with, and that was released in 1983, Too Much to Dream. And there was a question that I was going to ask you about it, but as a preface, I just wanted to mention that the first time that I had heard that album was at a Seattle record store. At that time, that was being operated by a very good friend of mine, and her name was Francine, and the name of the store was called Uniwax Records, and Uniwax Records in Seattle was pretty much the leading and exquisite dance music store in the Seattle area at that time, and that's where I had heard it, and I just remembered when I was listening to that album. The whole thing, when I was at her store, it was very mesmerizing. The vocals were fantastic. You did a great job on that, if I may say so. And the Patrick Cowley music was fantastic coming through there as well. But there was another thing, too, that was really weird, and I remember this clearly. when I was listening to that album for the first time, as pretty much everybody in North America knows, Seattle gets a lot of rain. And the day that I heard that album, it was pouring down rain, which wasn't unusual at all for that area. And, you know, I was mesmerized listening to it. I'm hearing your singing, fantastic singing, singing fantastic lyrics. The music is great. But there was also kind of an atmosphere of melancholy from my experience when I was listening to that album. And I think the main reason why is because the city had learned relatively recently about Patrick Cowley's death. And so when I heard that album, it was like beautiful, but at the same time it was kind of melancholy too, because just the shock, you know, of Patrick passing away, and kind of, you know, it's just kind of hard to describe, you know, just the spirit of him coming through the album. And, you know, it was beautiful, but it was sad at the same time. Nonetheless, a wonderful, wonderful album. And what I wanted to ask you, Paul, is, you know, what were the good memories of working with Patrick during the recording of that LP, and if there were any, what were the not such great memories?
Well, actually, I think the best memories are learning to write songs, because we were right on target was really one of the first things we did where we actually learned that you had to have a verse and a chorus, and the verse had to go the same way, the first verse and the second verse, and then the chorus had to sort of pick the song up. And we were actually learning those things back then when we were working on that album. So when we did Too Much to Dream, we were actually recording the song that was done previously, so that was a remake. And as we would do a remake, we would learn something from it. Pushing Too Hard and Too Much to Dream were the two redos that we did at that time. And then we would try to infuse that into the other songs that we were just writing. So like Traveling Man and Love's on the Line and Shot in the Night and all the other songs. Because we didn't know how to write songs the year before. I was a singer and I sang other people's songs, and Patrick was a drummer and a lighting man. And then all of a sudden he had to produce, and he could produce the tracks, but then he had to get somebody to sing over the top. So all of that was just sort of happening as those things are being developed. Both his album, the Megatron Man album, and my album were the first two albums really that we did, where we were actually learning. Yeah, so we were learning to be songwriters at the same time we were recording.
Oh, amazing. And you would have, in some ways, you would have never thought that. I mean, it came.
Well, because we knew what we had to do. We just weren't exactly sure how to do it. So we just kept trying, and next thing you know, we had two albums, basically. And actually, his first album was done just a few months before, and then my album was done, but it waited all the way to the end of that year because we were waiting for his album to wind down, and then we put out the single right on target, and then we waited for that to wind down a little bit, and then we came out with the album. So it was sort of timing. They were really all done, the year before, they were all done by pretty much December in 1981.
Oh.
And then later in 82, he actually did his second album, and which actually those songs were even a little bit more down because he was winding down. His creativity was like this huge burst, and it went right along with him getting ill, unfortunately, and it just seemed, it was almost like he had to drive it up because he only had a short time left. And, you know, looking back, it seems that way. Whether or not that's true, we don't really know, but it just sort of went, and then it was over. And unfortunately, because we, you know, I'm sure we would have continued for years together, because we were, you know, you asked if anything was ever bad. There was no real bad things other than the illness that we had to deal with. The way when we worked together, we were always excited and ready to try the next thing or whatever. And the only thing that brought us down was the fact that he couldn't keep up the level of, you know, interest at certain points.
Wow.
Yeah, it's interesting you asked that question, because that really brings me back there, and I haven't thought about that stuff in a long time. So,
well done, Rick. You that was an excellent question. I'm so glad you were here to ask it. I mean, wow, that really opened up a lot of doors.
Yeah. So, Paul, are you also Claire? Were you saying that the LP, that the full LP that you recorded with Patrick Cowley, that was actually completed before Patrick's solo second album and Patrick's solo third album?
It was completed basically at the same time as his Megatron Man album, his first solo album.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah, so Liftoff. So really it was like the Right on Target and the Too Much to Dream and the Shot. There was all the Paul Parker solos, and then there was the Patrick Cowley singer things, and there was a few instrumentals like Sea Hunt. And at one point the album came out, and then there was some legal problems, and they had to pull two songs off the album because they had been singles on another company prior to that. So that was
his first
two huge hits, Come On, I Want to Take You Home and Minergy. And those come off the album, and then they replaced those with Sea Hunt and that little song that Patrick sang that was Team Planet, it was called.
So there
was actually two releases of the Megatron Man album. There was the first release with Menergy and Take You Home, and then the other release with those other two replacement songs. But all the songs all the songs were done in 1981, pretty much.
Oh, wow. You know what blows me away about Patrick Cowley's solo albums, and by the way, before I ask that, how many of the songs did you sing on his off of his albums that he did?
It was just Liftoff on the first Megatron Man album, and I'm going Liftoff.
Is that you?
That's me, yeah. And I sing all through it. It's sort of a Manhattan Transfer kind of a vocal through that whole thing. Actually, we could play that one now. That'd be a good time to play Liftoff.
Well, actually, your wish is my command.
Peter.
On those three albums that Patrick did, the first one being Menergy, the second one being Megatron Man, and then Mind Warp, you know what really blows me away, Peter and Paul, is that there are no bad songs on any of those albums. I mean, it's brilliant. It's absolute brilliance. And even the third album, which is apparently, my perception is that's when he was really getting sick. Even the Mind Warp album is so fantastic.
Yeah. And on Mind Warp, then I was on Technological World as the lead, and then I was on Going Home in the singing group on that one.
Your work is superb, Paul. I mean, your voice is fantastic. The stuff that you did on those albums, including your LP that came out in 1983, absolutely superb. Wonderful singing. I don't know anybody who doesn't like your voice.
Oh, okay.
Well said.
I mean, good
it's
stuff.
All true.
And then also the stuff that you did with Rofo, I thought was very, very
I didn't do that, though. That was just a rumor that I did that.
Well, why does it sounds like you.
I know it does, but it wasn't me. It does sound like me, but no, that wasn't me at all. I remember hearing that rumor way back then.
I feel so embarrassed. Then whoever sang on Rofo wanted to try to sound like you.
And that could be, although it's sort of a bluesy male, so,
Well, that's it for me, Peter. I just really loved asking those questions. Paul, you're awesome.
Okay, well, take care. Let's lift off.
Pardon me?
Yes. We're going to hit lift off. Yes, we're going to we got it all queued up. We're going to hit lift off. And Rick, DJ RXMX, you're always a great caller and always a great fun to have on the show. We love your energy and we love you.
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah, great talking to you, Rick.
Same to you, Paul.
Thank you.
Okay, good night, Rick. That's Rick from Seattle, Washington, the Emerald City, one of the amazing DJs up in that area that I have met by way of this show. And I DJed in the 80s, but it was in Portland, Oregon, and which is a big city but somewhat isolated. And I have to thank Glenn Rivera for introducing me to some of the big names in the business, and one recommends the other. And I've just I have the best DJ friends in the business and who are friends of mine. And Paul, I hope to rate being a friend also as we get to know each other. Bob, if you could run the liftoff track, I think that's where we're headed.
Does that take us back to the day or what, dude?
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah,
I'm noticing
that sound, that incredible textured sound that he had, was all done in a little 8-track studio, and he did mix downs. He recorded 6 tracks, and then he bounced those down to 2, and then he added things and bounced those down to 2, and then finally finished, and then so it's almost a 24-track recording, but all done on an 8-track machine.
Yes,
and
the tools.
And he was the expert of it.
Nobody gets how flawless these songs are and what we had to work with. It was like working with kerosene lanterns and you know, axes to chop off people's, you know, arms and legs when they needed amputation. Back
exactly.
in the day, it was
yeah.
so primitive, you could not believe what we pulled off and what you guys pulled off. All I did was play the records. But what you guys pulled.
And on that one, we had the Joe Carroll, Lauren Carter, and Carol McCran were the other 3 singers. And they were the Patrick Cowley singers. And they were just amazing. They were such wonderful. And it was a redhead, a brunette, and a blonde. It was they were like something from the Lucy show, basically.
Yeah. You know, one day, Paul, I don't think I can resist giving you a call for you to think out with me, and I can make notes about all of the girl group substitutions you mentioned. Norma Lewis singing for Marcia Raven and all that stuff. I've got to, I mean, that is such inside dirt that I must know that. At some point off the air, I'm probably gonna call you and then I'll have that in my mind and I can use it from time to time. But Paul, one wonders. You've done covers of Time to Time and Wicked Game. They're both fabulous. Have you thought of doing covers of your own earlier work with you can improve them. Obviously, the music cannot be improved. It's just fabulous. But to perhaps add a few things that would make it, I could easily see these tracks like Liftoff and the one that we played very first off the show, Right on Target, becoming huge major hits if they had the latest club sound to it. And it's so silly to have to do music that way to make it palatable. But there's a particular sound, you know, we have. Have you thought of redoing some of your own, just covering your own work?
I haven't, no. I don't know. It would be nice to return to some of them. That one in particular, Liftoff, one of my favorites, and then Right on Target, and that Patrick Cowley talky synth thing that's kind of funky and talky. I love those things that he did. And you can just kind of hear them mutating throughout the tracks, and they always come back again, and a lot of times there's an underlying one that you don't even notice until you really concentrate. And he just had a knack for beginning with those things and then overlaying things over the top.
Well, Rick, I have to tell you, you've pulled in a DJ from Miami, you've now pulled in a DJ from Seattle, and now you've pulled in a DJ from New York City. Victor, welcome to the show, VJC.
Yeah, hi, Paul.
Hello.
It's great to have you here.
Hi, Paul Parker. I'm sorry I called a little late because I was trying to catch a show at 9 o'clock, but I'm so busy. I obviously you don't know who I am. I'm the DJ that runs Disco 93.5 here in New York, and I know Glenn Rivera. And obviously, he told me about the new track of yours, "Don't Stop What You're Doing to Me," which is playing on rotation on Disco 93.5.
Oh.
I just wanted to pass that along. Because I know we don't have time. We have like 3 minutes, so I'm just saying it's a wonderful track, and it's playing on Disco 93.5, and maybe next time I catch you, and we can talk a little more.
Okay, great.
Well, Victor is the DJ. He does all of his shows live, or at least 90% of them. He is actually sitting there in his house mixing live over the audio stream, and the man is fabulous. And he's a lot of fun. Everybody loves VJC. And perhaps if neither of you mind, I can hook you up with each other's email addresses.
Oh yeah, that'd be
sure.
great.
Sure, no problem.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to somebody.
okay, no problem. We'll somehow get in contact with the emails. And
I'm a little bit out of touch as far as with what's going on right now. You know, it's amazing to go back to the old things here and sit and talk and listen to them. It's just kind of a lot of fun.
Sure, you
a
know,
lot of fun for me too.
Before I leave, You sound a lot like Larry Sanders. I mean, for some reason, while I'm listening, I thought you were Larry Sanders, but then it got, I think Peter or Glenn said, no, that's Paul Parker. I said, oh, okay. Because I think I called the show late, so I wasn't sure who was who. I sounded like it was Larry talking to Paul, but then it wasn't Paul. It was Rick Asham from Seattle.
Yeah.
Oh,
right,
Rick.
Another gem.
Okay, so I know the show's ending, so we will be talking somehow, communicating through email, and lots of luck in that. That's a great
thing. Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for calling.
Have a good night.
Thank you, VJC.
Take care.
Yes, Paul, this is absolutely the grand central for everybody. We've had everybody from Tom Zavarese to Tom Moulton to a list of people that I will forget and surely be beaten up over. We've had Jerry Bottom from the Trocadero that we've had. We've had you. And all of these, Glenn Rivera is the man behind this. If it weren't for Glenn Rivera, we would not be nearly as musically acknowledged as we are and as gratefully appreciated. And I would love to have you back on the show sometime because I have a feeling we've only scratched the surface. But I do need to rush you off. I'm sorry about that because we are ending at 11 and I need to do the outro. And God love you, Paul. Thank you for doing everything you do.
Well, thanks, Peter. It was wonderful. I had a great time.
It was wonderful for us. I had a great time, too. Good evening to you, sir.
All right, take care, and we'll talk again.
Thank you. And that is none other than the Paul Parker, the legendary Paul Parker, the fabulously good-looking and unbelievably talented singer. You know, that doesn't often go hand in hand, who took over the 80s and the 90s and is back again. We couldn't be happier. So, in closing tonight, I would like to have Cynthia Manley come up and sing Stand.
That was a tough pill to swallow. Because John Edwards was the best of the three, without a doubt. A man who had made his own journey and gotten somewhere on that journey. Started out making some rather conservatively
Ask any musician. The best music happens when the sheet music gets put aside and the gang just sits down and jams. Same thing here on The Horn. America's best liberal talk hosts free-forming together for an hour a night. Welcome to The Horn Section.
All right, that's two nights in a row, and silly me just realized that the intro is precisely 30 seconds long. Welcome to the Horn Section. I'm Bob Kincaid, and I'll get that fixed by tomorrow, I promise. Hey, John.
Hey, man. Okay, well, that explains a bit. I'll have to resend it to you.
that just speaks volumes. You know, and shame on me because I didn't notice that before, but, there's not a lot of space on the top.